This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, and thank you for joining us for our radio Main Street all across North Dakota this time of day. High school graduation is a milestone in a young person's life, and this year that milestone is being observed in a very different, as in socially distant, way in most places. Education has been deeply affected by the pandemic. Distance learning replaced classrooms, and the social experience of school went from face-to-face to virtual. North Dakota Superintendent of Public Instruction Kirsten Baszler has been dealing with it all since the state closed its schools in March. She recently spoke with Prairie Pulse host John Harris about the challenges that had to be overcome and the challenges that remain.
Kirsten, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
You've been busy. You and your team have obviously been doing so much. Can you talk about what's been going on with the distance learning and what teachers have been doing for the last 10 weeks or so?
Well, North Dakota has truly led the nation in standing up a distance learning program for all of our students. We stood up a distance learning program for all 115 plus thousand of our students in the state of North Dakota in a very short period of time. As you know, Governor Burgum declared that our schools would be closed until further notice on March 19th, his executive order, and he gave our school districts until April 1st to come up with a plan for full continuation of learning for each one of our students, and that learning must have started by, at the very latest, April 1st. So every school student in North Dakota, beginning April 1st, began learning at home in a variety of different ways. Some of our school districts are, depending on the age of our students, depending on the capacity of our school districts, some of those were school packets. Some of those were, it's a combination of some in-person materials that have been delivered by our amazing paraprofessionals and bus drivers across the state. Some have a combination of Zoom meetings or Microsoft Team meetings and Google Hangout and all those other good things. And they've been checking in, classroom instruction has been delivered. And I have a student cabinet group that I meet with. I used to meet with them every quarter in, remember the days where people traveled to buildings and met face to face? Well, we would meet every quarter. But in this time, I began meeting with them right away in March, and we've been meeting every week. So I meet with my student cabinet every week for at least an hour, and we have conversations. And so it's been very helpful for me to see from those student perspective, the lens that they're looking through and the combinations. They're favorite time is when they can hop on a team meeting or hop on a Google meeting classroom or a Zoom meeting, see their teacher, see their friends. They also have what they call interview time with their teachers, where some teachers are connecting on one-on-one for question and answers for those students. And I think that's been a real asset, those personal connections that sometimes didn't even happen when students were, going 50-minute period classrooms with their teachers. They've been able to connect on a personal way. Then you have kindergarten students that aren't really going to be hanging out on a computer and be interested in that sort of thing for very long. So I've heard from kindergarten students, though, as well, that they love getting on that screen and seeing Bobby, who they haven't been able to play with for the last 4 weeks, and at least waving to him and sharing stories and sharing toys like the old show and tell, that, the traditional show and tell. So I have to say our teachers, our families, our students, our educational leaders across the state have been so creative and innovative. You'll hear stories where teachers have known that their students individually need a particular thing, so they've driven out to that farmyard and sat in the yard, and as their students sat on the deck and provided some instruction back and forth on a makeshift chalkboard or whiteboard. And so what our educational community has done in cooperation and partnership with our families and our students is just remarkable.
You kind of answered a little bit of this question, but, even Matt Olean has a sixth grader. I have a sophomore in high school, and some of them struggle with this distance learning of getting assignments in and things like that. And, what are you hearing? And, you said they even go out and do a chalkboard out in the farm. But are you hearing a lot of that, or is that just isolated?
No, not at all. And so I am hearing from one end of the spectrum to the other. We have students out there that are flourishing under this type of distance learning, whether, you know, it be the personalized learning, and we have others that are really struggling. And I think that's what we really need to remember. Teachers have known this for quite some time, that you cannot teach a student a single way and every student will get it. So there's been a lot of conversation about personalized learning. And prior to the coronavirus, I think a lot of people misunderstood personalized learning for online learning. And we as educators knew that that wasn't the case, that it wasn't the tool of which we delivered. It was about personalizing and meeting each student exactly where they were. And some students will be able to learn very, very well on this distance learning method or the computer online learning method. Others are really struggling and they need that teacher to see that furrowed brow in between their forehead where it's like, I think I kind of get it, but I don't really get it. And then that teacher can be, they have that emotional relationship response where it's like, you know, I'm going to follow up. I'm going to go over to that student and I'm going to say, can you help me explain back to me what you think I heard? So that teaching is based on a relationship. And so some students need that more than others, but it isn't a one size fits all. So I haven't heard that this is going horribly for everyone. And I haven't heard that it's going terrific for everyone. It's in between. And I think that's why the art of teaching, and that's why we really need to celebrate our teachers, because they're trying to do that in a non-face-to-face, and where they're not in person anymore, but they really are rising to the challenge, trying to see that furrowed brow through a Zoom meeting or a Teams meeting, and then following up with a call afterwards or a one-on-one meeting with that student.
Yeah. Well, I understand There may be a soft opening, I guess I'll call it, for summer. Can you talk about what that entails and what that means?
Yes. So May 1st is when the governor announced that distance learning would continue through this school year calendar. And so that was the first decision that was made. And the governor said, no, we're going to continue distance learning through the end of this school year calendar. Then immediately we had to go on to the next decision. Well, what about summer school? And we have many, many of our school buildings and school facilities that are used throughout the summer for summer school, extended school year, which is similar to summer school, but it's specifically an IDEA, Individuals with Disabilities Education Act. And so summer school, the IDEA extended school year is used, our school facilities are used for. Some of our school buildings are used for childcare. Some of it is used for Head Start. Some are used for the 21st Century Community Learning Centers. And so a whole variety, we had to make those decisions. So the governor on Monday announced that our school facilities would be opened up for a soft reopening, and it would be dependent on a local school district's decision. So school board members, in consultation with their school superintendents, would make the decision whether or not they wanted to open for some academic activities, for no academic activities, or all of them that were allowed. And so this is a district by district decision. And we're hoping that some school districts will take advantage of it, dip their toe into maybe bringing students back to the campus, learn from what is going well. And the important thing is summer school is not mandatory for any student. And so it doesn't put our parents in a position of, I'm not quite ready to send my child back into a broader community. They don't have to if they don't want to. It also allows our teachers to make that same decision. Some teachers are may have some underlying health conditions, may be of a vulnerable population. Summer school is not part of their contract. So they can make a decision whether they want to sign an additional contract. So it will allow us to maybe, as you say, test run this soft opening.
Well, so basically summer school will not go on as usual is what I hear you say. Because I know some students take a class to get it out of the way in the summer for the next school year. So it's really going to be case by case on school districts?
Case by case. Summer school is used for some students to accelerate their learning so they can free up more of their periods and take more electives in that sophomore, junior, senior year. Sometimes summer school is made used to do some credit recovery. Mm-hmm. Some parents enroll their students in summer school to ensure that there's no summer learning loss, that they were on par, they were at grade level, and they don't want those 3 months off for their child to regress, if you will. But there's a whole gamut of reasons that people enroll in summer school. And we should remember that 18 of our counties in North Dakota have zero confirmed cases. And so in some of our school districts, I imagine that summer school may go on as it was in the summer of 2019, because they are experiencing a completely different set of circumstances than other counties are.
What about graduations? What are you hearing there?
Very few people outside of the world of education, unless they had a senior in high school, understood how emotional that decision was. And that was, as you can see in the timeline, we made the decision about distance learning, and then we made the decision about high school graduation ceremonies even before we made the decision about summer school, because that was a situation and people needed to make plans. Will families, grandpas, grandmas be allowed? Will it only be a virtual conversation or virtual graduation? So again, really respecting local control, understanding that there are some areas of our states that are being highly impacted by confirmed cases of the coronavirus, where other school districts weren't experiencing any. We provided the local control that North Dakota citizens have come to expect, and we're allowing our local school boards with their superintendents to make the decision about high school graduation ceremonies. We've seen some really unique ideas. The one that I probably like the most is, because of the mixed groups and the contact, that the minimizing and social distancing of the contact, generally during a traditional graduation, the principal shakes the hand, hands the diploma, a school board member may turn the tassel or vice versa. So that's a lot of contact between mixed groups. One of the best ideas is a couple of our school districts are allowing their high school seniors to choose a family member or close family friend to provide them, to give them their diploma. So those diplomas will be delivered in a sanitary way to that person. The senior will walk across the stage, have his or her name announced, and that close family friend or family member that they've had that are living in the same household will be able to hand them the diploma, shake their hand. And I think that's going to be, possibly even more special than that school board president or that principal handing them their diploma.
Well, you talk about creative. What do you think a virtual graduation might look like in a few weeks?
Again, some of those are coming about. I believe some in Cass County are going to have a virtual graduation with the possibility of an in-person one later in the summer. But there's lots of funny stories. I think what I've appreciated about the evolution in graduation in the last decade or so that I've seen is high school graduations are now much more student-centric. They used to be, when I graduated a long time ago, it used to have this adult come in, give you some words of wisdom. You didn't really know them, didn't you? Sat through it and you couldn't wait to like give your friends a hug afterwards. And so, but now graduation ceremonies are transitioning into some senior classes are electing their speaker. So it might be the funny kid, it might be the kid that has won the speech and debate and can really deliver an address. So I anticipate that some of our virtual graduations will include many of those same elements, where storytelling, memory sharing, thanking of their favorite teachers, thanking of those teachers that were hard on them but pushed them to be their best, and sometimes even classes have voted for their favorite teacher to give an address. So I imagine that's what virtual graduations will entail as well.
What is the plan for fall? And I realize it may change from week to week, but is the plan to have students back physically in the classroom?
So my crystal ball is about as black as it's ever been in my entire life and my career. But I am a glass half full. I'm an optimist, and I see our school leaders and I see our teachers already planning for what fall will look like. They're eager to see their students again. So if I wouldn't take this bet to Vegas, but my prediction is that we will be back in our school buildings this fall. I think this opportunity for us to have this soft opening in June and July will allow us to really refine and hone in on the things that we need to do. We're already working with our Office of Management Budget, OMB office at the department, working with our Regional Education Association directors to do some supply orders, some joint supplies and collaborative supply orders for things like hand sanitizer, masks, those types of things. So working on preparing to get us back in school for the fall. With that being said, we all know how early the flu season hits in general in North Dakota. We are asking every school board and every district leader to begin to plan for and include their plan for the 2021 school year, a future disruption if necessary. We don't know how far along we'll be in a vaccination or how far along. I'm confident in our governor's leadership that he is really building a testing and contact tracing infrastructure that I believe even when we enter into the flu season this fall, I'm so proud of the way that we are working as one, as government at the state of North Dakota, between the Department of Emergency Services, the North Dakota National Guard, the Department of Health, the Department of Public Instruction, the Governor's Office. We are preparing and creating an infrastructure that even if we do have a resurgence of the COVID-19 virus this fall, that we'll be able to mitigate that in a very swift and rapid way, that it won't cause a mass statewide shutdown of our education system again.
Mm-hmm. Do you have any concerns over students falling behind, sort of losing ground as they come back next fall and because of what we're going through right now?
So one of the things I want to say, as I said, North Dakota has led the nation in this distance learning. And what we've been able to deliver for the last 9 weeks of the school year has been tremendous. And it certainly is better than many of my, I have friends all over the nation. And there have been students that they were released from school the middle of March and haven't had a day of instruction from a teacher or their school since then. The Spokane School District in Washington, one of the hardest hit and first hit, they haven't had any instruction. So what we've been able to provide is better than what many students have been able to receive in many other parts of the nation. But with that being said, we should know that that instruction that we've been delivering through distance for a large majority of our students hasn't been the quality that they deserve and that they are used to when they have that face-to-face interaction with their students. So with that being said, we have to acknowledge that we are going to have the challenge of understanding when our students come back into our classrooms, that each one of them, if you have a classroom of 25, each one of them is going to be at a very specific place, and it's not going to be a normal start of a school year. But I really want to emphasize this to all of our students out there, all of our parents out there, or family members, aunts, uncles, grandmas, grandpas that have been helping our students learn these during this last 9 weeks. No child is ahead. No child is behind. Every child is exactly where they need to be. And we have teachers that are superheroes. That's their superpower, is when they come back into the classrooms, they are going to be able to identify where that child is, where their student is, meet them where they are, and get them exactly where they need to be. So for all of you family members all of you students who are trying your best, doing your best, please know that you're not behind, you're not ahead, you're exactly where you need to be.
Education is the most important thing, but what about the student athlete? What was it like to make the decision not to even finish the sports out for this year? And what have you heard there?
So the North Dakota High School Activities Association is a membership organization that governs those decisions. Matt Fetch is the director of that organization and an extremely strong, exemplar leader. He has led the board through some really challenging questions that they needed to decide. And I, as the state superintendent, sit as a board member on that board of the North Dakota High School Activities Association. But I can't say enough about Scott Probotsky, who is the superintendent of Devils Lake Public Schools, is the president this year. All of my colleagues on that North Dakota High School Activities Association board of directors, I rely on them to really lead this discussion. And I have been nothing but impressed with the conversations that they've had. They are long-term, you know, high school principals, local superintendents, athletic directors, activities directors themselves. They know up close and personal how important these extracurricular activities are to our students and the well-rounded experience that we want our high schoolers and our middle schoolers to have as they go to our schools and as they leave us. It's probably been hardest on our seniors that were looking forward to their last year of speech and debate, their last year of band and choir, their last Class B tournament. As you know, the Class A tournament got shut down midstream, and there was the announcement that Class B would not be occurring the following week. There was the hope that we would be able to hold on to, that maybe we could have those, have our spring sports and have our have those tournaments later this spring or summer. When it came to the realization that we weren't going to be able to do that, really, really hard decisions. But I hope that our our parents and our student athletes know that in the scope of things, trying to keep grandma and grandpa and or an aunt and uncle, or even a mom or a dad that might be vulnerable, that that's really some tough things. But again, I'm going to fall back on where we live in the upper Midwest, that we have some incredibly supportive coaches, teachers, parents, family members, and even themselves. So again, I'll fall back on my student cabinet. They were very disappointed. I have two seniors that are on the student cabinet, one from Richland 44 and one from Napoleon. They miss those things. They were highly and heavily involved in those extracurricular activities. They're sad, but the dignity and the understanding that they have exhibited through all of this, they understand that their loss of those activities pales in comparison to what they are doing as individual citizens of North Dakota to keep everyone safe. And so I think we should celebrate, if we can, as a state, help them focus on what a wonderful, responsible, contributing factor they have played in keeping all of North Dakota safe.
North Dakota Superintendent of Public Instruction Kirsten Baszler in a conversation with Prairie Pulse host John Harris. You can see the show in its entirety this evening at 7:30 Central on our television service. Next on Main Street, Natural North Dakota.
This week on Radiolab.
Very funny. What a funny idea.
Mr. Google thought that right in front of the homes, they should build a bus stop.
A bus stop. To nowhere. There's no bus coming.
No bus?
Never.
The story of how one nursing home used a bench and a lie to save their patients. I'm Jad Abumrad. Join me.
Saturday at noon, 11 Mountain, right here on Prairie Public.
You're listening to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. What's in a name? With place names like the Bald Hill Dam, there's often some interesting history. That's the subject of today's Natural North Dakota. Naturalist Chuck Lura found the source of the name of the Bald Hill Dam in a book that included a journal entry with a first-person account 180 years ago.
Bald Hill Dam. Have you ever wondered about the origin of that name? Bald Hill? I've been rereading portions of a book, Joseph N. Nicollet on the Plains and Prairies, the Expedition of 1838 and 39, with journals, letters, and notes on the Dakota Indians, translated from French and edited by Edmund and Mary Bray. On their way to Devil's Lake from Fort Pierre, South Dakota, during the summer of 1839, the Nicollet expedition traveled for a long time along the Cheyenne River north of what is now Valley City. Here's a bit of the journal entries from July 23rd and 24th, and I quote, "After 13 miles, we camp in good time at the mouth of a little river, which comes from quite far away to the northwest, flowing from a big salt lake. The voyagers name it Bald Creek, because of one hill slashed by a vertical cliff without vegetation, which is on the right bank of the Cheyenne near the junction of this river. These bald hills are about 150 feet above the bed of the river. The bald hills are remarkable. They resemble Indian mounds made by the hand of man. There are seven or eight of them, round and conical, lying the slope of the plateau along the river. Their base is at various heights above the river." Unquote. The editors note that the hills were southeast of Cooperstown, in an area altered by the damming of the Cheyenne River to form Lake Ashtabula. It's interesting to note that Gordon Hughes from the University of North Dakota Department of Sociology and Anthropology, in cooperation with the North Dakota State Historical Society, conducted an archaeological study on two burial mounds in this area during the 1940s and discovered human bones along with several artifacts. So it appears that at least some of the Bald Hills were burial mounds. Over the years, the Bald Hills became Bald Hill, perhaps in large part because of the naming of the dam. Some of those Bald Hills may still be intact, but for most people, I suspect that Bald Hills, or maybe I should say Bald Hill, will only be associated with an 1,800-foot-long and 60-foot-high earthen and concrete dam on the Cheyenne River north of Valley City. I'm Chuck Lara.
Natural North Dakota is supported in part by the NDSU Central Grasslands Research Extension Center. You can read and hear today's story at prairiepublic.org.
Coming up on Main Street, News Director Dave Thompson recaps the stories that made headlines this week, and Matt Olin reviews the big-screen version of the stage musical Cats. First, the news.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. The legislature's budget section has unanimously approved the plan to divvy up part of the federal funding the state has received as part of the CARES Act. The money, $1.25 billion, goes to the state government as part of the assistance Congress approved to deal with the COVID-19 pandemic. The budget section approved spending $524 million of that. It will consider more spending in its June meeting. Part of the $524 million went for an interest rate buy-down program aimed at small business. Another part helps to replenish the state's unemployment insurance fund. $50 million goes toward paying for the plugging of non-producing wells, which will help keep people employed in the Bakken. House Majority Leader Chet Pollard of Carrington.
It's important for North Dakota to get their upstart going here. The $200 million interest buy-down is important. Of course, the unemployment trust fund is. I'm looking forward to get this economy to start getting it back on track. So I'm just asking folks to give a serious consideration to a yes vote.
Lawmakers say they hope some of the remainder of the CARES Act funds will be able to go toward unemployment insurance. They don't think now is the time to raise taxes on employers for that fund. The 2020 census count has been delayed by the pandemic, but groups wanting to ensure that children are counted are getting their message out. In Minnesota, efforts are underway to educate families and communities of color. The state has declared May 15th as Count All Kids Day. It's estimated that 2% of children statewide are missed in the 2010 count. Nationwide, children of color were missed at double the rate of their white peers. Jennifer Bertram of the Children's Defense Fund in Minnesota says the undercount of young children in the last census cost the state nearly $200 million in federal aid. And as Congress considers providing more long-term help for pandemic recovery, she says a more accurate count will help young kids who have already seen the effects of achievement gaps during the crisis.
Just reflecting on who has access to reliable internet is really making a difference in terms of how children can get access to their educational needs right now and who has access to proper nutrition.
Advocates fear that the number of young children missed could double in the 2020 count if enough awareness is not raised. And the Minnesota legislature has a Monday deadline to finish its work. There are several unresolved issues, but GOP Senate Majority Leader Paul Gazelka says he's optimistic. He says talks continue with DFL-controlled Minnesota House and the governor on a bonding bill. He says when Governor Walz ended his stay-at-home order, it brought the two parties a little closer together.
We're all trying to focus on COVID-19 and what do we do about getting the economy up and running safely. And so that seems to be moving, which then I think triggers all the other things that we want to get done.
One sticking point might be state worker contracts. Gazelka says he wants to renegotiate those contracts to stop a second pay raise from taking effect during this economic downturn. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
Well, that sound in the background is the wire machine that introduces the Friday regular guest, and that's Dave Thompson, our venerable news director, who joins us to talk about the week's big stories from our studio in Bismarck. Hello, Dave.
Hi, Doug. How are you?
I am very fine. I know that, of course, the big story is the one that's been the big story all along.
It is, yes.
And that's COVID-19, so let's jump into it. What's the latest number?
The latest numbers, it looks like we have two more deaths, and one is Cass County, one is Grand Forks County. The Grand Forks County person in his 40s, the person in Cass County is a bit older than that. Both had underlying conditions, so that's the case. And, you know, this thing has been about flat. It's been about 53, 54 new cases. So it's been kind of flattening out a little bit, so that might be a good sign.
But 42 dead at this point.
We have 42 dead, yes.
And the preponderance of the deaths, and for that matter, the positive cases, are on the eastern edge of North Dakota.
Absolutely. And Cass County by far has the most. And a lot of them are attributed, at least in, I would say a good share of them are attributed to problems in long-term care facilities. Where you've got people who are locked down kind of there, and then somebody comes in and maybe a carrier doesn't know it, and that could be a real problem.
Well, I believe in Minnesota, the percentage of the deaths that have been attributed so far have been in nursing homes, 80%.
Right.
And it looks to me that North Dakota is in that range as well.
Right.
So testing is a big deal, and it has been, talked about for weeks nationally and in the state. We're still not necessarily where we need to be, and until we are tested, we don't really know.
And that was the interesting thing from the Thursday briefing Governor Burgum had. because he wants to get to 4,000 tests by the end of May, 6,000 tests a day by the end of June. He said one of the things that's holding it up is the fact that we need more labs. And, you know, the lab right now, the state lab is doing a lot of work. It's testing about 80% of the tests that have been made. And they're running 24/7, 365 with a lot of staff and some temporary facilities. And he said that that's well and all good, but if you're going to get to that many tests, then you need a public-private partnership with something like Stanford Health or maybe the Mayo Clinic, something that his administration is looking into. So, and then you can step up the testing.
And if you get a test, it's 2 or 3 days before you get the results. And
right.
I'm told that you won't get a result if you tested negative. They won't call you.
They won't. And that I found that interesting from Todd's story. When he went to Grand Forks yesterday for that mass testing event, he was tested, and that's what they told him. If you test positive, we'll get a hold of you in the next couple of days. If you test negative, you won't hear from us, which is kind of interesting. And that's where no news is good news at
okay.
that point.
Well, let's move on to another ongoing big story, and that is education in the state of North Dakota and nationwide. The governor is going to allow some soft openings of North Dakota school facilities for summer activities.
Right, summer schools, as long as there's social distancing and people are, you know, in fairly large spaces with not a lot of students, he's doing that, and then also some other school activities. And this has to be, you know, handled a little bit carefully because although it seems, and I'm going to put the quotes around seems, that it's targeting the older populations for more severe cases, it doesn't mean that they're not in younger people as well, and younger people may be carriers. So that's a real concern about that. So he's, you know, putting the toe in to open, and then this is a kind of also a dress rehearsal for a potential reopening of schools fully this fall.
All right. But 20,000 students last year used school buildings in the summer, so it's
right.
A big
and,
deal.
Of course, there's also the, you know, the ACT and SAT tests that have to be given, and a lot of those are given in summertime as well.
Well, we're looking at a very interesting time in education, and for those seniors who graduated virtually, as many of them will, whether or not they're going to take a gap year to go to college or wait until things
question.
Settle down, that's going to affect admissions at the state's higher education institutions, and that's a big question mark right now.
That is a huge question mark. People really don't know. The colleges do not know yet what their populations are going to look like, and then you've got what is staring them in the face, and that's a 10% possible cut in their formula funding from the state of North Dakota. You can make up for it if you have better tuition coming in, more students coming in, you can room and board, but that's not a given either.
No, this could compound that problem.
It really could. Now, we should also mention that in terms, you brought up graduations, there are going to be some limited graduations that are going to be allowed on school grounds. But again, social distancing and make sure that you stay home if you feel sick, the basic guidelines for the smart opening.
Well, let's move on to the closings. The North Dakota State Fair has been canceled.
So is the Red River Valley Fair, I noticed that.
So is Host Fest. So is the Detroit Lakes Northwest Water Carnival. That's the first time in 80-plus years. So this is unprecedented stuff.
Have we heard anything about WeFest yet?
I wouldn't be betting on it, but no, we haven't.
Either. But yeah, there are some outdoor concerts that are going to be closing. However, right now, at least for the moment, the Medora musical is going to start its season in June. We'll see what happens with that.
Well, we'll see how they space the spectators out in that huge outdoor amphitheater grandstand.
And that's, you know, outdoor is a little bit better to space things out, and there's going to be people who can maybe not be in the grandstand themselves, but be on the hills around the Burning Hills Amphitheater, something like that. So, you know, there's some ways to space things out, but if you get a real demand, what are you going to do?
Well, it's a big, beautiful show, so
it
maybe
sure
it'll
is.
Go on. This story is no surprise, but I guess the real surprise is in the number. Record low air travel in North Dakota thanks to the coronavirus, and that number is wildly low.
How about 5,000 passengers for a month?
Wow.
I mean, in talking to Kyle Warner, who is the Aeronautics Commission director, he said people ask him to compare it to what happened after 9/11. 9/11, there were still about 25,000 passengers leaving North Dakota. But because of COVID, it's down to 5,000 passengers. Some airports are seeing maybe one flight a day or two flights a day. I checked with Bismarck Airport. There are five flights a day leaving from Bismarck now. That's down quite a bit. And the planes are not running full at this point. However, Warner says it looks like there might be a slight uptick as things start to ease. So that could be a good sign.
Well, meanwhile, airlines are announcing or hinting very strongly that they're going to be much smaller when this is over. They're downsizing.
They're downsizing, and the price point could be very interesting when we get more of demand again. And, you know, it's not necessarily that cheap to fly out of North Dakota to some destinations. And you have to go through a hub, which would be basically Minneapolis, Chicago, Dallas-Fort Worth, and Denver. I think those are the main hubs for Bismarck, for North Dakota flights, right?
Yes.
And you have to go there to fly someplace else. So if you want to go to Hawaii, you have to fly to Minneapolis or something like that. So with whole hub-and-spoke concept, it just begs the question about what are the prices going to be if you need to fly?
Yeah. The state's Department of Transportation has reopened, although it's sort of a limited, soft reopening.
Right. Driver's licenses for kids or driver's permits for kids. CDL, which is, those are the commercial driver licenses, those are open now. Motorcycles and motorcycle tests are open, but a number of the other services are not yet open as they try to do a soft, gradual reopening as well.
Well, let's talk about a story that you have mentioned before in previous conversations. Bismarck is working to replace cast iron water mains and the lead service lines. This is an issue that has emerged in other cities around the country, and now it's getting some attention in the capital city.
It certainly has. In some of the older parts of Bismarck, some of the lead service lines, we're talking about from the curb junction where the actual water main goes in and joins with your water line that feeds your house. Some of those are definitely lead and need to be replaced because, you know, lead in the water, that's not good. So now there's a plan, there's some money that's been made available to the city of Bismarck where the city will pick up 90% of the share to replace those lines.
Well, that's a bargain. So
that is a bargain, it really is.
Having had one of those replaced a long time ago, it was very dear then.
I was going to say, wow.
that's a big expense, and of course it requires digging up a fair amount of the lawn too.
Right, it does. And I remember I lived in southern Bismarck. And growing up, and when they had to replace the water lines then, what a mess that was, but they had to. And so, you know, it's going to be traffic disruptions, but they're going to try it as fast as possible. And the good news is for homeowners that they'll only have to pay about 10% of the cost.
Well, the city of Winemere is taking advantage of some loan money to replace its storm and sanitary sewers.
And right, and it's part of a street replacement project. They want to get... So they don't have to replace asphalt every 4 or 5 years. They're trying to get draining to be improved so they can get the water out of the area and for the storm sewers to be improved. And it's all part of what the mayor calls, you know, kind of a beautification and an upgrade of the city to make it a little bit more attractive to people who may want to live in that area.
Well, it's an interesting time to be doing construction. There are a lot of people probably looking for some work, and city projects like this might be well-timed.
Yeah, very well-timed. And, you know, a city like, you know, Winemere, which is down there, it's close to the Gwinner plant for Bobcat. And the mayor said that he's seeing some people who actually commute to Fargo-Moorhead who live down in his neck of the woods as well.
Well, let's talk about Jamestown looking for some state money for a fire truck. They've got one that's pretty old, I take it.
Yeah, well, it's an old truck. It's a 1980s vintage fire truck. It's owned by the state of North Dakota because the state bought it to take care of fires that might have happened at the state hospital. Well, the truck has been damaged and basically has been totaled out. The state got a check for $13,000 on a $25,000 deductible insurance policy. Think about that for a while.
Wow.
But they're not interested in replacing the fire truck. So the city of Jamestown went ahead, got the money out of its fund that it used to replace equipment, about $1 million to replace that truck, is going to come to the next legislative session to seek about $333,000 of that from the state of North Dakota, with the proviso that they'll provide fire protection for the state hospital and also the James River Correctional Center. It's been an interesting story. It's been going on for a while, and it's been the subject of, a little bit of argument between the city and the state?
Well, we check in with our news director, Dave Thompson, every Friday. And incidentally, during the COVID-19 pandemic crisis, we've heard his voice Sunday mornings at 10 a.m. Central for Main Street Weekend, giving us an update on the pandemic and other stories. So, Dave, it's always a pleasure.
Thank you, Doug.
Last week on Wait, Wait, we tackled the most important issue in American jurisprudence. Who flushed a toilet during Supreme Court oral arguments?
Was this a sitting Supreme Court justice or a standing Supreme Court justice?
I'm Peter Sagal. Put your seat down and make yourself comfortable as you listen to this week's news quiz with special guest figure skater Adam Rippon. Join us for the news quiz from NPR.
Saturday at 10 Central, 9 Mountain, right here on Prairie Public.
Arts programming on Prairie Public is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, a state agency developing, promoting, and supporting the arts in North Dakota.
It's time to go to the movies with Matt O'Lean. And Matt, this week you went to a movie that's streaming online, as so many are these days, Cats, which opened in late 2019, in December, I think, and didn't wow people, as I recall.
No, it sure didn't, Doug, and now it's available on Prime Video for $2.99. So, yes, I decided to throw caution to the wind and watch the debacle that is Cats the movie. It was a box office bomb. It was a critical bomb. I think, essentially, Doug, it's a theatrical experience. Cats is something that is probably better on the stage, even though I think it's a very overrated musical. It's based on T.S. Eliot's writings about cats. As you probably know, Doug, Andrew Lloyd Webber wrote the music. Memory is the big song from the show, as people probably know. But the problem here is not that work wasn't put into it. There's some theatrical sets. The plot, if I can just do it very quickly, is almost like a musical review. There's not a lot of plot in this musical. It's about a young cat named Victoria, played by ballet dancer and singer Francesca Hayward, who is abandoned and finds herself in this cat community called Jellicle Cats. And that is where the plot goes. There's a lot of characters that pop up. There's not a lot of character development. The essential plot of the film is one cat will be chosen to ascend to the Heaviside Lair for a new life. And so it's this competition among cats to see who's going to get this new life and fly away. And through it all, Victoria watches and becomes part of the community. So one of the big problems with the film, Doug, was the initial trailer was met with such negative reaction by audiences that by that time they were stuck with what they had. And here's what they did. So I think the major mistake here, Doug, was to put the CGI cat outfits in later. So the actors trained, they learned to move like cats, they sang, and they did all this, you know, live on a soundstage, but without cat outfits on. So later the CGI was done to put fur and whiskers on all of the actors. But the problem was when the film premiered in December, a lot of the CGI was not ready. It was edited right up to the end. Judi Dench famously had a wristwatch and a wedding ring on. So you could see that in the premiere. And then a second version was released to theaters about a week or two later to replace the first version because CGI stuff was then corrected. This was almost unprecedented in anything I can remember. So the CGI is woefully off. The look of it just looks ridiculous. And I'll never get the image of Rebel Wilson rolling around on the floor, acting like a cat out of my mind probably for the rest of my life. It's just, it's a misfire in terms of tone, Doug, and the production design and how it looks, and it just doesn't come off. In fact, it becomes almost boring. That's the one problem I had. My daughter and I watched it, and 20 minutes in, she was bored. And a musical that's supposed to be vibrant, like Oliver or West Side Story or Cabaret, three musicals, by the way, that made good movies, should not be boring.
This show ran for 20 years on Broadway and in London, premiered in London. And I agree with you. It's a musical review. Every cat gets a turn. They've each got a song.
Yes.
But there isn't much of a story there. And to be honest with you, I found it dull, like your daughter did. And I've seen it on stage, and I wasn't exactly wowed by it there, although I got to see my nephew play one of the supporting roles, and he was a lot of fun. But it just doesn't do much for me, and I guess I was surprised that it didn't do better at the box office, although, as you mentioned, the trailer was a very strong negative in terms of the audience response, and I read somewhere that the trailer, they spent more time on that than they did the movie. And at any rate, it's not quite making the amount of money it cost to create it at this point. So I would say that it's a failure for the most part, although it'll somehow break even eventually, I imagine, down the streaming road somewhere.
The film is such a failure, Doug, that Rebel Wilson and James Corden, who both were in the film, at the Oscars presented an award, and they made fun of their appearance in Cats. Rebel Wilson was, like, pawing at the microphone, and only 2 months in, this had become an embarrassment for the actors in it. Now, two actors in it, I think, actually rise above the material. Francesca Hayward is a ballet dancer. She moves like a cat. Her movements, they're very good, actually. But she observes a lot. Her character observes a lot. Even when the big song Memory comes in, she gets to sing part of it, but Jennifer Hudson sings most of it. And Taylor Swift, who appears for 8 minutes with a number, actually, I think, pulls off her number. And she was the one person that got pretty good reviews. So those are the two, I think, that probably did okay. Idris Elba is hilariously miscast, and his singing is not good. Ian McKellen in Cat Whiskers, it just doesn't look right. Judi Dench has a lion mane. It's all just stuff you can't get out of your head, and it shouldn't have been allowed. I think, in retrospect, Doug, they should have either gone full CGI, like the Lion King remake, okay, and put voices in of famous people, or go full animation. What they did was a combination of live-action performances and CGI, and that was the problem. If you've seen it on the stage, as you have, Doug, it almost comes off better because you know the actors are in cat suits, and you just suspend your belief because you're at a theater. But in film, it's a different medium. It's very different. I think when they were making it, they probably thought it was going to be great, and sometimes you can be so close to something that you can't see how ridiculous it looks, and then people are brought in to watch a trailer, and they're aghast. It's hideous. And all of a sudden, they had nowhere to go. Once that trailer came out, they couldn't go back and completely CGI the film or make it animated. They were stuck with what they had, which was miscast actors like Rebel Wilson and James Corden and Idris Elba in cat outfits. They looked like CGI fur.
I didn't quite buy the outfits, and I agree with you. On stage, you are impressed by the makeup. On the film, you are not. Andrew Lloyd Webber, though, has had such a run of fantastic musicals. Jesus Christ Superstar, Evita, Joseph and the Amazing Technicolor Dreamcoat, Phantom of the Opera. This is a guy who is a phenomenon on stage and has left a film legacy as well. But I didn't realize that he hadn't won an Oscar except for Evita, right?
I don't know if he has won an Oscar because it's all adapted scores from his musicals, and they've now gone to only an original score Oscar.
I did look him up, and he won the best original song for You Must Love Me, which he wrote for the movie version of Evita.
Okay.
Well, you mentioned a couple of names that are in Cats, and these people won Oscars, and they won them for the same actual supporting role position. So who are they?
Judi Dench, supporting actress for Shakespeare in Love in 1998, and Jennifer Hudson for Dreamgirls in 2006.
All right. We've seen Cats. We've been to the movies with Matt
Olin. We've seen it, yes.
So I play in a fantastic punk band called Sacred Cash Cow.
That darn low-down, dirty, no-good rat hornswoggle me out of my paycheck.
I'm really just against the homogenization of pronunciations.
Join us this week for Away With Words.
You can't hang around a barbershop and not get your haircut.
That's Away With Words, Saturday at 9 Central, 8 Mountain, here on Prairie Public.
This is Dakota Datebook for May 15th, celebrating the 100th year since the passage of the 19th Amendment, which gave women the right to vote. This series is written and voiced by Sarah Walker.
On this date in 1914, Mrs. Harriet Darling Hall, National Women's Christian Temperance Union lecturer and organizer, was in North Dakota, traveling around the state and lecturing. She was said to be a strong and forceful speaker, and many looked forward to her talks. Her first stop was in Fairmount, where she spoke to about 200 people, and the town held a suffrage parade. The Bismarck Tribune noted that Hall had organized new local WCTUs, which would make their special work for the summer the agitation of the suffrage question. Many local chapters would follow this lead, offering speeches and opening conversations on the topic of women's right to vote. The Women's Christian Temperance Union had an interesting relationship with suffrage. The group was founded in 1874 in response to the effects of alcohol in the community and in the home. However, after Frances Willard became the organization's second president, the group began to address other social issues. Suffrage was formally endorsed by the organization in 1881. Willard recognized that the vote of women would help in achieving the organization's goals. An assessment of attitudes toward women's suffrage among the state-level WCTUs showed that while the Midwest and the West were generally supportive of suffrage, the women in the Northeast and South were less than excited about the prospect, with some decidedly opposed to the idea. Willard reframed the concept of women's suffrage within the WCTU to garner support from members who did not believe women needed to be involved in politics. She promoted suffrage as part of a campaign for home protection, telling the groups that women's suffrage could protect the home and family, away from the public political arena and into the domestic terrain they were already involved with and wanted to protect. Willard was friends with suffragist Susan B. Anthony and collaborated with her and various women's groups. She supported suffrage, but she also thought voting should be contingent on an education test, applied to both men and women. This is Sarah Walker.
This series is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota and the North Dakota Women's Suffrage Centennial Commission, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
James Ainsworth felt socially distant before this pandemic. He uses a wheelchair. Group activities can be tough. But now with so many options online, that's changed.
I was able to meet new people and feel like I was a part of the group in a way that I hadn't been.
His story and the latest news, Saturday on Weekend Edition from NPR News.
7 a.m. Central, right here on Prairie Public.
Thank you for joining us today for Main Street. On Monday, our Bill Thomas will talk with author John Kenny about his book, Love Poems for Anxious People. It's described as welcome wit and wisdom in this age of coronavirus. And we'll hear about a podcast produced by students at West Fargo's Liberty Middle School that focuses on teenage mental health issues. Our Sunday morning show at 10 Central will feature Joy Ryan, head of the North Dakota Boys and Girls Ranch, and Lee Fralick, the director of the University of Minnesota's Center for Forest Ecology. We hope you can join us for Main Street on Sunday morning and Monday through Friday right here on Prairie Public. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of your day.